I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. According to emails released by the Secret Service, agents joked about Jesse Jackson being assassinated. Should employees who date coworkers be required to sign a love contract? And should LA police toughen immigration enforcement after the killing of a black high schooler? That's all on our bloggers roundtable. And with us today, freelance journalist Danielle Belton. She runs the blogs Black Snob and the Secret Council of American Negroes. Former Los Angeles Superior Court Judge Kevin Ross. He blogs at Three Brothers and a Sister and hosts The Kevin Ross Show on Blog Talk Radio, and Brandon Whitney runs the blog Homeland Colors. He also writes about politics for the websites Black Men in America and My Voice DC. Welcome, everybody.
How you doing?
Thank you
for allowing us to be here today.
Always. All so right. Let's start with a topic that we covered on the air yesterday. In March, 17-year-old Jameel Shaw Jr. was gunned down outside his home in South Central L.A. The man accused of killing him is an alleged gang member who's in the U.S. illegally. Now, the family of Jameel is now proposing Jameel's law, which they hope will crack down on illegal immigrant gang members in Los Angeles. It's seemingly increased tense relations between Latinos and African Americans in parts of Los Angeles. Yesterday on the show, we spoke with Jameel's parents, Army Sergeant Anita Shaw, who was serving in Iraq when her son was killed, and Jameel Shaw Sr.
He saw this black kid walking on a quiet street, and he was out there looking for blacks to kill anyway, so he just stumbled up on my son. But at the same time, he stumbled up on public outcry. This has been going on before my son was murdered. This isn't the first time. It's just been disguised, you know. And people are waking up and realizing that there are people out there today that are killing people because of their skin color.
All right, Kevin, Mr. Shaw is not shy about saying he thinks that this was a race crime. What are other folks saying in Los Angeles? Is it a race thing, a gang thing, a random thing?
Yes. All the above.
All the thing.
All the above. What's interesting about this case, having spent a number of years as a prosecutor here in Los Angeles and three of those years in the hardcore gang unit, one of the things that's interesting about gangs and violence and this whole gang culture, which we didn't see so much in the last few years, but with technology being where it is right now, you have this issue of what they're calling net banging, where individuals get online and they may not necessarily be active in the gang from a standpoint of actually doing any killings or murders or drug exchanges back and forth, but there is this glamorizing of the gangster lifestyle. So you have this Jameel Shaw young man who, by all accounts, seemed to be someone who we would herald as the person who could be the valedictorian that would take out the Anglo valedictorian at Morehouse and all of that thing. But what we also have is this issue of him really kind of glamorizing this lifestyle. And so the question becomes now, was he actually flirting with this type of gangster mentality? And it's very compelling when you see those images of him seemingly flashing gang signs. You cannot live in L.A. and not understand the concept of red and blue. And he had it all over him. And so you have to ask the question, is it race or is it gang or is it a combination?
Yeah, Danielle, he was allegedly, and we're talking about the victim here, Jameel Shaw Jr., flashing a gang sign on his MySpace page. That is the image that people have seen. And now there are a couple of activist groups in Los Angeles proposing that MySpace actively look for gang-related words and images and et cetera on MySpace and take down any pages that have that. Danielle, do you think that's going to work? Do you think it's a good idea?
Well, it sounds like a good idea in principle, but I don't think it's going to work. Basically because there has been a huge, huge glamorization of gangster culture going back as far as when N.W.A. first hit the national scene as a rap group. And even early N.W.A. talked about the perils of life in Compton and on rough L.A. streets. They didn't necessarily glamorize it as much, but when you each successive rap group since then that has been qualified in the gangster rap category, it's gotten less and less about, oh, we live in a poor neighborhood, oh, horrible things happen here, we're just telling our stories, to, oh, I'm crip walking and it's so cool. I mean, Snoop Dogg, constantly references him being a crip and crip walking in his music on like very, very popular songs like, Drop It Like It's Hot, that you'll hear on radio, all the time. So it's not surprising that he would have something like that up on his MySpace page and not actually be a gang member, because you have so many kids who just see that as, oh, it's just interesting, it's just neat, you know, I just want to claim it. I mean, I can remember being
That's what they
kid.
Call them, apparently, claimers, people who are,
yes.
you know, kind of interested in the gang life but not absorbed in it.
Exactly, exactly. And like when I was in elementary school, when the film Colors came out, you know, I didn't see it because my parents didn't allow me to see anything but, you know, Walt Disney films. But it was like as soon as that movie came out, almost every kid in my elementary school was all of a sudden like, oh, I'm a Blood, I'm a Crip. And it just seemed insane that, you know, that they would want to be part of that. That they weren't actual gangbangers. They just thought it was cool because they'd seen the movie Colors.
I'm sorry, I've got that theme song running through my mind right now. It's a very mediocre song, but somehow it's stuck to a little
colors,
part of my brain.
Colors.
You know,
colors.
My biggest fear about it, though, is more than the gang element, is the anti-immigration spin, which is possibly there. For about 200, maybe 300 years, poor whites in the South got distracted from issues that really affected them because they were worried about race as opposed, you know, instead of economic issues or health issues. I'm afraid poor and middle-class African-Americans can get so caught up in this anti-immigration fervor that we ignore the issues that affect us at a greater level.
But, Brandon, I have to tell you, with all due respect, it's not just poor and lower economic class African-Americans. The issue of immigration for someone who spent 15 years in the court system, you definitely have this issue with African-Americans saying, we are not getting construction jobs. We're not getting jobs where individuals are being paid under the table. And so when you have this issue of Special Order 40, which is what you were alluding to with respect to changing the law so you can't get additional information from people who could be illegal in this country, you are really tapping into an issue that transcends party, that transcends gender, that transcends economic class. There are a number of African-Americans, myself included, that really have an issue with our illegal immigration policies.
Brandon, do you think this is going to come up in the election this fall?
I don't think it's going to be as big an issue as it has been in the past, only because I don't think either party knows what to do with it. And they haven't been able to get any type of legislation one way or the other through Congress, and I don't think it's going to happen before this election in November. But again, it's the type of issue that people can get obsessed with, they can become Minutemen and things of that nature, and it does not improve their lives at all. The reason that there aren't jobs, blue-collar jobs, for middle-class African-Americans and middle-class whites is not because of immigration. It's because those jobs have been exported to other countries. And that's because of the way we set up our trade agreements. And what has happened is that the immigration issue has become a red herring of sorts, something to just focus on instead of focus on the real issues. And it's dangerous for African-Americans to fall into that trap because, again, poor whites in the South have been stuck in that trap for about 250 years.
I actually want to move on to – go ahead quickly, Daniel.
Oh, okay. I was just going to say that I agreed with him to a certain extent, but I lived in Bakersfield, California for 5 years. And a lot of the resentment that I found that most African-Americans felt was that most Mexican-Americans were completely ignorant to the struggle that Black Americans made to get the rights that they benefited from in California. So a lot of people felt, you know, hey, you know, I did all this work and they're giving me all this attitude, telling me that I'm lazy, telling me that I need to get myself together, that, you know, that the Black people are bad. And it's like, I suffered for you.
Right. Well, some people would argue that Cesar Chavez hasn't gotten his due as a civil rights leader, where his work would also affect African Americans.
Yeah, but that's not just illegal immigrants either. I mean, most ethnic groups are unfortunately ignorant about the African American contribution to the United States,
including African Americans.
Exactly.
Exactly. So
hello.
It's not unique to illegal immigrants, it's so many different issues, and illegal immigration is such a small part of the problem that we need to deal with.
Yeah.
All right, let me move on to a lawsuit by Black Secret Service agents. It's turning up some controversial emails. Reverend Jesse Jackson ran for president in 1984 and 1988, and like all major candidates, he got Secret Service protection. Now, this lawsuit dug up an email titled Righteous Reverend, and it jokes about a fictional death of him and his wife when a missile struck their plane. The email ends with, quote, "It certainly wouldn't be a great loss and probably wouldn't be an accident either." So, Kevin, since getting wind of the emails, Reverend Jackson now requested to read every single one concerning him and his family. Should the Secret Service release them?
Absolutely. And the reason that I say that is you look at this from the broader context of this 2008 presidential election, and you have seemingly amongst many African Americans this fear of Barack Obama's safety. And you have these individuals who who have basically sworn their allegiance to potentially take a bullet for the person that they're guarding. I think it undermines where we are from a standpoint of, can we get past race? You know, what's interesting about this whole conversation about Jesse Jackson, who's to say that those same dynamics could have been taking place when Mondale and Geraldine Ferraro were running for office? And so I think that for the government to establish themselves, because right now we're looking somewhat with a jaundiced eye as it relates to this country, through their actions and individuals who work for the government, showing institutional racism.
Now, Brandon, Jackson also wants a congressional investigation. Do you think that's necessary?
It probably would be. I don't have a lot of faith in Congress in terms of investigations, though.
Brandon's a cynic, huh?
Yeah, just a little bit, just a little bit. But, I mean, I think it basically just brought to light some things we've already known. Like, racism still exists. It's institutional. And it's good to bring it to the light. We don't want to see racism where it's not, but we do want to recognize it where it is. And we have to say, okay, this happened. How do we fix it? And take the appropriate action. And so I think, you know, maybe Jesse isn't the best person to take it to the forefront, because a lot of people, because of who he is, will not give the type of attention it's due.
But that's exactly why it should be him. I mean, when people talk about Miranda and your Miranda rights, most people don't realize that Miranda was a drunk. And this individual had a long record and was not anyone that was necessarily known as being this upstanding citizen. It's because it is a Jesse Jackson that would make people say, okay, you know what? If all the presidents, we've had 43 white men, you know, Barack Obama isn't the first African-American. People are all on this bandwagon about why are blacks so gaga over Barack. I'm like, hello, Shirley Chisholm, Cynthia McKinney, who's running right now. Nobody's even talking about her. Carol Moseley Braun, you can go on. Al Sharpton, Jesse ran twice. The real issue is, are we transcending race? And when it raises its ugly head, we need to deal with it.
I think yeah,
let me get Danielle in, because I want to move on to another topic after this. Some folks say, and I think this is what Kevin was alluding to, that this is grandstanding by Reverend Jackson because he wants media attention. Do you think that's fair to say that?
Well, I don't think it is, because, I mean, this is a really serious issue. It makes me think of, in some ways, you know, the Secret Service and the military have some parallels, whereas the military can't work unless everyone's on the same page, everyone's on the same team and working towards the same goal. The Secret Service can't work unless everyone agrees the number one, you know, most important thing is to protect who we're assigned to protect. And that is, you know, that is the above all goal. It's not funny to joke about. This is the reality. This is our job. We're all on the same page.
So, I think it's also interesting
that's what it's really about.
Yeah, that if that's how little they valued his life, it says a lot about
exactly
how much the rest of our lives as young African-American men and women are valued as well. So I think it kind of plays into a lot of the stuff that happened with Sean Bell and every other young African-American man whose life is in danger when he gets pulled over.
All right, exactly. Got to go to one final topic, and we don't have a lot of time, but it's a little spicy. You know, some folks find love at work. Some people end up filing sexual harassment lawsuits instead. And some companies are now asking employees to sign a consensual relationship agreement or a love contract. And it basically says, look, if you guys are having a relationship, don't go ahead and file any sexual harassment suits when things are over. Danielle, do you think that that's fair, or is it overstepping the bounds of the company?
Not totally needs to happen. I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, I've worked in places where you have office relationships. People go, you know, above and beyond. It gets ridiculous. You know, they people step over the line. And so I can fully understand why a company would want to do that.
Now, see, Danielle, I'm going to have to respectfully disagree, my sister. I just started a company. It's called Three Base Media Group. So now, me being an employer, I'm looking at it from a whole different standpoint, because those liability issues come into play. And I would submit to you that if it were your company, you may have a little bit more of a sensitivity from a standpoint of, look, I'm paying health and dental and workers' comp, and I have to retain an attorney. If you all are going to be doing all this on my time, I want to make sure I'm protected. And I think that's the perspective that most employers are taking.
I think it's a sign that the laws.
I was actually agreeing
with
you.
Yeah, I think that Daniela does agree with you.
I think it's a sign that the laws just need to be tweaked a little bit. I mean, it's if you can get sued as a company because somebody came on to somebody else in the wrong way, and you haven't had an opportunity to respond to that yet, it's unfair. And I understand why they want to defend themselves. So The laws probably need to be tweaked a little bit so that they're a lot more reasonable than they probably are at this point.
I've worked at a lot of companies where there are tons of intercompany marriages. And, you know, considering how much of our time we spend at the job, at the J-O-B, I mean, Danielle, it sounds like what you're saying is that there should be legal protection, but there shouldn't be a barrier on dating. What do you think about the idea of just saying banning dating in the office?
No, I can understand dating because, I mean, often what happens is, and, you know, I've worked in journalism and my mother's worked in education, and a lot of times the only people you know are other teachers in journalism. The only people you know are the other journalists because you spend so much time at work. So it's understandable that, you know, people would seek all their relationships at work as well. The only problem is that you just have some people who, you know, they just cross the line. We had a young man at my last newspaper who was fired because he basically made some untoward statements about one of our bosses having a relationship with another, with an employee below her. So it's just... It's just messy. It's just very, very messy.
It's all these women bosses. That's what it is.
Uh-oh. Kevin, why do you always have to blow up our letter segment? Why do you always have to blow it up?
I'm just the Rush Limbaugh of NPR. I'm sorry. I had to just throw it out there for the sake of...
We don't even have time to respond to that. So
I'm teasing.
So I'm going to have to let you guys go. Thank you so much. And we've been talking with the controversial former Los Angeles Superior Court Judge Kevin Ross, who blogs at Three Brothers and a Sister. He also hosts the Kevin Ross Show on Blog Talk Radio. He was here with me at our NPR West studios. Brandon Whitney of the blog Homeland Colors, he was at our headquarters in Washington, D.C. And Danielle Belton, who runs the blogs Black Snob and the Secret Council of American Negroes, she was at member station KWMU in St. Louis, Missouri. And you can find links to their blogs and ours at nprnewsandnotes.org. You can also go and speak your mind in our ongoing series.